The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. No fans in stadiums for potentially the next 6 months. The government's halt to test events prompts an angry response from the Premier League and the EFL. Questions then, is it the right thing to do? Will clubs get financial support? And what does this mean even lower down the pyramid? In the Carabao, West Ham Hull goes ahead despite Moyes and two players testing positive just before kickoff, while Orient Spurs is postponed. Elsewhere, shocks on the pitch. Joel Linton scores twice, but it's normal service elsewhere as Pickford chucks in a couple. Also, a review of some of the new films out today. Luis Suarez in the Italian test, The Alpaca goes for goal, and Ryan Reynolds goes to Wrexham. All that, plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Simon Burnton, hello.
Hello.
Looks very much from the Zoom that you're sort of driving a coach.
Oh.
I don't know why, it's the camera angle or something.
I've got quite a big window just to my right.
Yeah, coach driver. Nor, in my experience, coach driver is very angry. You're sort of, I would say, too amiable to be a coach driver, Simon.
Okay.
I mean that as a highest compliment.
Well, thank you.
Ah, my pleasure. Philippe Auclair, bonjour, ça va?
Bonjour, ça va très bien. Merci. Et toi?
Ça va bien. And that ends the French. Anne-Marie Batson, welcome back.
Thank you for having me. Hello, everyone.
That's all right. You did well enough on your debut to merit a second appearance. This is it's exciting. But it's the difficult second album, Anne-Marie. You know, it could go either way today.
Yeah, that's true. I could be like Sheffield United second season syndrome. Here we go.
And let's bring in the chief sports reporter at The Guardian, Sean Ingle. Shawnee, nice to have you on the pod. It's been a while.
It has, yeah. I was original OG back in 2006, but some people have forgotten about Shawnee, so to speak.
Well, the difference is you and Barry, the OG, one of you has been promoted many times and hence is too busy. The other is Barry. So, and for those asking, he'll be back next week. So listen, at a meeting on Monday, the sports governing bodies were told to prepare for having no spectators throughout the winter. Officials from the Department for Culture, Media and Sport told the meeting that the ban on fans will be kept under review. The Premier League made a very strong statement saying, we're certain that through league-wide guidelines and a code of conduct developed with scientific experts and agreed by the government's sports ground safety authority, fans in stadiums will be as safe or even safer than at any other public activity currently permitted. This is already evident in other European leagues. The EFL, their chair, Rick Parry, said it's a little bizarre people are allowed into pubs but cannot attend football matches. There's been a lot of talk about the government sort of bailing out football clubs. Sean, as of Thursday morning, which is when we're recording, what's the latest?
Well, I mean, things always change with this government. You know, what is policy one minute can change the next. But as things stand, the government are really wanting the Premier League to do their bit to help the lower leagues. That's they're putting pressure on them. I mean, they say to them, well, look, you know, look at how many the transfer business is still millions being spent. Why can't you offer, you know, 250 million to help the lower leagues? I think there is some resistance. I mean, that's clear for when you look at Sean Dyche, the Burnley manager, sort of saying, well, you don't get the best hedge fund managers helping out the worst hedge fund managers, so why should football be any different? But the likes of Frank Lampard have sort of said, well, actually, of course, we need to help the pyramid. So that's one element. The second element, I think, is that the government is separately working on a plan for up to 8 sports, including football, to help out. But there won't be, it won't be billions, it'll be millions here and there. It basically stems the bleeding. It doesn't really help the sports back on their feet. So you can understand why football is worried. It's losing £100 million a month. And they look at the government and they don't really trust them to really come through on this.
Lots of people have come out and spoken, you know, since the announcement and the halting of these test events. The Colchester chairman, Robbie Cowling, saying, with this one decision, you've not only threatened the livelihoods of staff at Colchester United and local businesses that rely on our club, and not only those staff and local businesses of every other football club in the EFL, but those of every club across every sport in the UK. The Dover chairman, Jim Parmeter, says, look, we've got a week, maybe 2 weeks left without some kind of decision about when the National League can even start. You know, and that's being replicated, you know, across the whole of the football pyramid. Do you think, Sean, the Premier League will give money? And it's hard to know. I mean, I was surprised about what Sean Dyche said, but at the same time, you know, Arsenal were making their own redundancies only a while ago. It's their costs are higher as well, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the Premier League are split, but I think the optics here don't look good. So I do expect them to give some money at some point. But as always, I mean, you need agreement, and it's not easy. You know what the likes of, you know, Manchester City might think are very different to what the likes of a Brighton will think. So I think it will happen, but it may not take place overnight. I'm told in the meeting that the Culture Secretary Oliver Dowden had with Sports on Tuesday, he said to them, Boris does get it. He really does. But as someone said to me inside one of the sports, that the problem with Boris is he thinks as long as the Premier League's going on, everything is OK. And he doesn't seem to grasp that actually once you go a tiny bit below that, things are very, very different.
And is it safe? I mean, we've heard people, you know, people who obviously have a vested interest in fans getting in saying, look, it's safe. We've done all these things to make it safe. It's safer than going into pubs, etc. I know you've written a bit about the sort of technology that could be involved.
Yeah, I mean, I spoke to a guy called Botan Osman, who's the chief executive of a company called Restrata, and they've been working with English cricket and also the Indian Premier League. And if you'd been to an English cricket match this summer, whether it was a test or at, say, Surrey, and you're a spectator, you would be given a sort of essentially a Bluetooth fob that you would have to carry on you. And if it meant that if you went out next to somebody for more than 30 seconds outside your bubble, it would beep. It also would alert someone in a control center, so that, for example, if too many people were on a concourse at one time, the stewards could then say to people in the stay in your seats. So the idea is that you're never, you know, social distancing could happen. Obviously, it wouldn't be a full stadium, but you might well be able to get a third of stadium people into stadiums, which is what the clubs were hoping for. And Osman told me that, you know, using technology to monitor and manage fans would give sport more of a fighting chance. And to be honest, that's all that clubs want. They do recognise that we're in unprecedented times. They do understand that public health matters most of all. However, there is that sort of middle ground between shutting everything down and having full stadiums. And that's what they are so frustrated about, because thousands of jobs are going to be lost here and clubs could go under unless there is real and substantial support.
Sean, we'll let you go and do some proper work, but thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Sean Ingle there, the chief sports reporter. And Sean was saying before the pod that, you know, there were 60,000 fans in stadiums in the top two divisions in Holland at the weekend. And Philippe, the situation in France is very different as well, isn't it?
Yeah, in France, basically, it's 5,000 spectators are allowed to follow the games. And since the beginning of the season, so we're starting to have, in the beginning of the season, the latter part of August. So we're starting to have an idea where the consequences are on the health front. And very interestingly, so far, touch wood, there have been no clusters reported around any of the sporting events which have taken place with, because it doesn't just concern football, it concerns also other sports, but football being included, since then. So that it hasn't been linked to new surges in the infection rate, which, as you probably know, is just as bad, if not worse, in France than it is in England at the moment. And there is no plan at the moment to cut back on the number of fans who are in stadiums. And also, apparently, tomorrow, I think the Italian health minister is going to announce that they're thinking of, I mean, they will bring back fans in the stadiums with a capacity of up to a third of the capacity. So it's a bit strange to see English football going one way with spectators in stadiums and most European countries going the other when their health situation is not necessarily better than it is in England. And there's also another thing, you know, bouncing on what Sean was saying, and when it comes to the help that the French clubs are getting from the state. The French state has already contributed something like 2.8 billion euros to the game, which is a lot. So this has been, some of it's comparable to the furloughing policies. That's one thing. Another is the fact that clubs can take loans at 0% interest, which can be reimbursed from 2021 onwards. I mean, it's only in advance, but it does help. And also there is an exoneration of employers' contributions, you know, for national insurance up to a certain level. But all of these put together has meant a financial help of 2.8 billion euros to football clubs. I mean, they're still moaning and saying that they should get more money, but there has been a genuine effort.
What is amazing to me is to have a Conservative government, this really quite right-wing Conservative government, suggest that it is the responsibility of the wealthy to pay for the poor. Like, it blows my mind that in any aspect of life, they believe in wealth redistribution. If it can apply to this corner of society, then, I mean, surely their entire ideological construct is crumbling at the moment.
I suppose as well, is there a danger, Anne-Marie, that because we are football fans and we are desperate to see football fans in stadiums, and I've occasionally felt a bit guilty sort of watching a Premier League game and sort of forgetting and getting carried away, and then watching Carabao highlights and going, wow, this is really bad, isn't it? There's no one there and it's quiet, and what is the point? Is there a danger that we are instantly critical of anything that means fans can't go in stadiums because we want fans to be in stadiums because we prefer football to opera, for example?
No, I don't think there is a danger, because it just feels like, as somebody, as you mentioned in your introduction, the policy changes day by day. It's such a fluid situation. One minute one decision's made and the next minute another decision's made. And I think what is frustrating from reading all the correspondence that came out yesterday from various owners and chair people was that they had started to implement their own plans for the return of fans back into stadiums and grounds from the 1st of October. And granted, it was a potential date, but it was still a date to work towards. It gave them a goal to work towards. And then suddenly it's a massive U-turn again. So I don't think there is a danger. I think this can be applied, as you mentioned, opera there, sport, culture, arts. At some point, life has to return to some sort of normal, in inverted commas. And maybe the conversation should be around now, particularly around sport, is to how to manage the situation rather than going, right, let's stop it and let's go back to plan B or plan A or plan ever, whatever it's going to be, because it just creates a period of more uncertainty, more concern, more frustration, and so on and so forth. And particularly, as Philippe's just pointed out, there are other countries that are somehow putting plans together and making it work. And I think with England coming to a full stop again and then seeing other countries in Europe making plans and going forward, it creates that, well, it gives the impression, what are we doing? We just don't know what we are doing as a country. And for me, on the outside, it looks like the government's just applied a one-size-fits-all solution to this issue without actually addressing individual needs. And that's what needs to be looked at here. And I'm sorry, but I don't think the Culture Secretary is doing a good enough job with that. I think he's just looked at it as a whole and made a decision about it as a whole rather than looking at individual aspects which need to be addressed.
Tim got in touch with us and he wrote quite a long thread, and it's not a question, but he just says, as a fan lucky enough to go to one of the pilot games at the weekend, I'd like to share my top five moments. One, welcoming the team for our kickoff for the first time in 6 months. It was a lot more emotional than I expected it would be. Two, seeing Shrewsbury score a real life goal. Three, the first ironic cheer for a shot blazed over the bar. Four, the first ironic cheer for someone hoofing the ball out of the stadium. Five, the inevitability of our keeper rushing out and performing a complete air kick, allowing us to concede what turned out to be the winner. Ultimately, it felt like a success as people were well distanced, 95% plus wore masks throughout. So far, this does not appear to have led to more cases locally. It's a shame that less than a week later, the prospect of fans attending EFL and Premier League games seems as remote as ever.
I just think that a search for a decision that will apply to every club, that decision looks very distant. But there will be some clubs that are more capable than others of staging COVID-safe football. For example, you probably need a club to have many different access methods, so public transport and fans arriving on foot and by car. And those stadiums that can achieve that should be allowed to achieve that as soon as possible. And maybe they would agree to share that income with clubs that don't happen to be able to do that. You know, if we could allow 60,000 fans into English stadiums paying £25 each, that's £1.5 million a week coming into the game that isn't currently coming into it. And if that could happen safely, and if allowing that to happen would allow people to enjoy themselves and get out and to cherish something that they've been deprived of, I don't see how that's not beneficial for everyone.
And it could be a modular approach as well, what you're saying, Simon, because if you say, like, I've seen what the Arsenal have put in place for the return of fans, it's really, frankly, really impressive. And also because of the way that public transport, you know, is really, really good in the area. But if you say, well, you can have 12,000 fans at Arsenal, well, maybe you can have just 700 at Leyton Orient. I don't know. You modulate it in function of the facilities. And therefore, and that is in itself, my goodness, what a breath of relief it would be for all of us, and especially for the smaller clubs. And also, not forget women's football, which is also getting a massive hit because of this decision.
Now, the Hull City manager, Grant McCann, explained why his team rejected West Ham's offer of free coronavirus testing prior to their 5-1 Carabao Cup defeat on Tuesday. During the first half of the third round tie, it transpired that David Moyes, along with Issa Diop and Josh Cullen, had left earlier in the evening after Monday's test results came back positive, while the rest of the Hammers squad were clear. Grant McCann explained that Hull's medical staff were content with the precautions West Ham had taken and that the match was fine to be played after consultation with the EFL. He said, "We felt we were fine, no one showing any symptoms or anything like that. We always monitor the players' well-being on a daily basis, whether they're feeling good or not. We can get tested whenever we want. We're following the guidelines of the EFL. That's what we're doing. Just because someone offers you free testing doesn't mean you do." On the same night, Leyton Orient Spurs was called off on the afternoon of the game. There was a lot of Leyton Orient players tested positive for COVID. Did they do the right thing? Are you surprised that game went ahead, Anne-Marie?
I'm really genuinely shocked that game went ahead, given what was happening down the road at Leyton Orient, who took a more sensible approach. And I think if somebody's offering you the opportunity to take a free test, take it, for goodness sake, because it's there. Take the opportunity. I don't understand why. And doing a little bit more deeper reading about this, I didn't realise that not every EFL club is compelled to have a test. Where it's compulsory in the Premier League, it's not necessarily the same for the EFL. I just assumed, you know, every club in the EFL would have a test regardless, but apparently that's not the case. So I don't think the game should have gone ahead. I don't think it was right. I think Hull should have taken those tests because, you know, it's in the statement that the manager gave, you know, the players may feel fine, but of course we know with this virus you could be asymptomatic. You may not necessarily show any symptoms whatsoever and still have symptoms of this particular virus. In David Moyes' case, when one of the Davids was talking about it on the radio the other day, he said that Moyes had a sore throat and that was pretty much it. Apart from that, he felt fine. So I don't think that game should have gone ahead, regardless of the outcome of the result. I think it should have been postponed or cancelled and rescheduled at a later date.
In the Times today, there was an article saying that West Ham are hopeful that David Moyes can be on the touchline this weekend. Disappointingly, the story then went on about how he's having a number of tests and maybe, you know, when he was found positive, it could have been 10 days in and so maybe he's found negative. I thought they were thinking about some sort of hazmat suit and I was absolutely all in favour of Moyes being, you know, or just some sort of orb to have Moyes just roll like a giant gerbil wheel that he could roll around the London Stadium in. I would all in favour of that. Anyway, that'll do.
What I've been picturing is I read that Moyes was going to manage the game remotely at the weekend. I'm picturing him with a PlayStation handset, controlling his players from home.
Or just on a Zoom on the big screen where he's shouting and Mikel Antonio's going, you're on mute, David.
That's the one.
Mute. And he's just there yelling at Robert Snodgrass to get back. Anyway, that'll do for part one. Part two will round up some of the Carabao Cup results. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. So the Carabao Cup happened. A few of the results. Fleetwood 2, Everton 5. Jordan Pickford with another two mistakes. I mean, he's fun in the mistakes that he makes because he makes the mistakes in such a sort of frenetic way, Simon, that it almost makes them look worse than they are, I think, in a way. Even though, you know, the first one, well, both of these were definitely mistakes.
They were. And the way the TV cameras linger on him after his mistakes and he's looking around as if to see if anyone's laughing at him. And, I mean, you really pity the guy. Though one of the problems is, I mean, obviously his confidence is in a very dark, like, he's in a bit of a dark place mentally, I think. But he was so good at Sunderland, partly because he was distributing the ball quickly and so accurately up the field to Defoe in a way that Everton never asked him to do. Like, they have taken away what he is best at and left a slightly short-armed goalkeeper who was probably never more than an 8 out of 10 for shot-stopping. They've taken away his best attributes and they've just left a kind of shell of a keeper is what we're seeing at the moment.
Ryan says, how acceptable is Fleetwood's Captain Pugwash music for a goal celebration? Is it more acceptable when keepers make hilarious mistakes like Pickford did last night? That is not fair to throw one in and then... Jacko said, before the Chelsea-Barnsley game, on Monday you mentioned Tony Callio, ex-Fulham player, who famously kept Ronaldo quiet in Euro qualifiers in 06 and 07. Tonight, another Finn, Apo Halmer, gets to show his talent as Barnsley faced Chelsea. Will Havertz, Abraham and others stand a chance? Yes, is the answer to that question. They hammered them 6-0, a hat-trick for Kai Havertz. That'll give them some confidence. Arsenal won 2-0 at Leicester. Newcastle won 7-0 at Morecambe, which is a shame because Cambridge won 5-0 there at the weekend. And I thought that would be... it sort of puts our result into perspective. Richard Jolly's fact of the pod. Joe Linton scored more goals against League One and League Two clubs than Premier League clubs. He's 3-2 up at that at the moment. And Dean Henderson saved a penalty for Manchester United against Luton.
I was quite struck by the team that Arteta chose to play at Leicester.
Tell me more.
Well, because when you look at it and you think, cripes, it's not very far from a first 11 here. I mean, actually, I exaggerate perhaps, but it was not a B team. So it takes that competition rather seriously. And that surprised me rather a lot. I mean, actually, I think of all the players that he could have called on, the only one which missed out on the trip to Leicester was Aubameyang. Everybody else was there on the pitch or on the bench. So he's taking this competition very, very seriously.
How good is Eddie Nketiah?
People at the club are convinced he is very, very, very good. That's something. It's not new. I mean, it's something. I remember when Thierry Henry was actually looking after the youngsters, he was already talking about Fast Eddie as if he were going to be a big player for Arsenal Football Club, and he's improved. I mean, what's it? He really has jumped from one category of player to the next, which not all the Arsenal youngsters have done. I think, for example, Nelson can still progress to a much higher level. I think Willock can as well. He is with Saka, the one who has really improved quite markedly, and is showing it. I mean, you've seen his scoring records for Arsenal now, as well as for the England under-21s. It's remarkable. And he's not just fast. He's got a real instinct, goal poacher instinct and intelligence of movement in the box as well, as well as his natural speed and ability, technique and so forth. So yes, he's pretty good.
Excellent. Now, Anne-Marie, transfer chit-chat. Anne-Marie, you wanted to talk about Manchester United's lack of business so far in the winter, the sort of wild rage that is happening on social media, especially since Crystal Palace did them at the weekend.
Yeah, I think wild rage is a great way to describe it, Max. And I'm hoping someone can help me. I'm hoping Simon can help me here because I'm trying to understand what's going on with the relationship between Manchester United and Manchester United fans. Because I'm not a Manchester United fan, but for me, as a neutral in inverted commas, I think they did a pretty good job last season, you know. And I wouldn't have, at the beginning of the last season, I wouldn't have thought Manchester United would finish third in the Premier League the way things were going. And I was astounded that they managed to achieve that. And I know reaching three semi-finals, some people say that's still not good enough, but it's still a small step in the right direction for me. And I think the years of wilderness under David Moyes and Louis van Gaal and then Mourinho, love him or hate him, he started to take them a little bit out of that, of the abyss. I think Ole Gunnar Solskjaer deserves some credit and a little more time to develop the squad into what he sees will take them forward, just like Jurgen Klopp did for Liverpool, and believe in his own team. I think Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, for me, is somebody who believes in the long term. I know that there are issues at the back. The one player I think they desperately need back to full fitness is Eric Bailly, because that central partnership between Victor Lindelof and Maguire is clearly not working. If they can get Bailly fit and into that partnership, probably with Harry Maguire, I think they've got a good chance of doing well this season. But also, the elephant in the room is the transfers. Again, the fans are looking how quickly Chelsea secured top services from top, top players, and Liverpool has done exactly the same. And then they look at Manchester United and go, it's 2 weeks left before the close of the window. What are we doing? And I do feel for them, because I'm sure that pressure is on them all the time, because I'm hearing that phrase, but we're Manchester United. We are Manchester United. I know you are, and I know you really want to do well, but you're going to have to give the manager time, but also the manager needs to speak to the board and find out what on earth is going on with the transfer budget.
Do you think Jose was, I mean, they must have been really in abyss if Jose was taking them sort of in an upwards direction from that whatever abyss they were in. But do you think Bailly and Maguire is good enough? I mean, that's my feeling, is that they're, you know, that they've spent so much time on Sancho, and clearly you don't just do one transfer. It's not like Championship Manager 93. You can do more than one transfer at a time, but like the pursuit of Sancho at the expense of trying to get a brilliant centre back, while, you know, Chris Smalling is being quite good at
Roma. Absolutely, Chris Smalling is doing a fantastic job, and obviously there's discussions about that, whether or not he's going to stay. I think there is a confidence that Eri Bailly brings to that back line, but the problem with him is that he is injury prone, and he played in the game in the Carabao Cup against Luton, which I have to say was a slightly laboured performance. Even though Juan Mata got that goal in the first half, they were literally saved by Marcus Rashford at that 88 minute goal. But I think if Bailly can stay fit, it just adds that extra 1-2% that they need in that back line. It's all about slim margins for Manchester United, small tweaks here and there. And I think that point you make about Jadon Sancho, there's been so much focus on him. I think they've forgotten that they needed to sort out the back line, particularly the central partnership, but also left back.
They can't forget, can they? Like, they're looking at it all the time.
They are looking at it all the time. But, you know, Borussia Dortmund have been really clear about what their position is. I don't think Jadon Sancho is not the entire solution, I should say, to Manchester United problems. There are other things going on in that team that need to be addressed.
To play the devil's advocate, and at the risk of being insulted and threatened, but Harry Maguire, is he as good as people say he is, or is he a victim of the Phil Jones syndrome? Do you remember the Phil Jones syndrome?
Of all the syndromes, Philippe, that's a brutal one.
Yeah. No, I remember when Phil Jones burst onto the scene, I believe is the expression, that there was a lot of excitement around him because of his qualities as a defender, and that people say he was progressing and become this marvellous kind of new Bobby Moore kind of figure. Honestly, people were really genuinely, seriously saying so. And Maguire has had an excellent progression and so forth, made to the England team on merit and so forth. But I'm just wondering if there hasn't been a tendency to overlook some, perhaps, I wouldn't call them deficiencies, but some of the less, perhaps...
You're trying to say he's slow, Philippe, right? He's slow.
He's very slow. And you can't be slow. Unless you've got somebody who is next to you who can compensate for that.
And that's where Eri Bailly comes in for me, Philippe. So to interrupt you, I think that's the balance that they need, because you're right, Harry Maguire is slow as described, but that's why Bailly can help with that, particularly stopping crosses and so on and so forth. So yes, I think it's just getting that balance right because I think they have to play Harry Maguire purely because of the price tag on his shoulders. I think they have to play him. It's just a question of who plays next to him. And I'm sorry, Victor Lindelof is not the answer.
Simon, Max Aaron's to Barcelona's fun, isn't it?
That is fun. I mean, it's so beautiful. And just the idea of being, you know, Lionel Messi's been the best player in the world for as long as Max Aaron's can remember, right? Since he was basically at the start of his primary school. The idea of being Max Aaron's Norwich right back and then going to training with Lionel Messi, I mean, that it would properly explode your mind. Your mind would explode. That would not be good for your football career. But my God, I mean, the idea is phenomenal. I know Barcelona aren't now what they were 6, 7, 10 years ago, but even so, it looks like it may well not happen. So I guess he's had the chance to dream without getting the realization at the end of it.
Now, Luis Suarez is heading for Atleti. after this wrangle with Barcelona. As Sid was saying on Tuesday, Barcelona just at the last minute realising that Atleti were also in La Liga and perhaps didn't want to give Suarez to another team in that, because he might have been going to Juventus. And this absolutely brilliant story about the police investigating whether a university helped Luis Suarez cheat in his Italian language exam. You've got to get a B1 exam if you want to get an Italian passport. It's part of the sort of test to get in. You've got to be able to speak Italian. And the Suarez sat the exam at the quite brilliantly and very Brexity named University for Foreigners, which I really love the name of it. I mean, maybe a translation. So, you know, maybe it doesn't sound quite as you go over there as it does when it's translated into English. The university said, in relation to the investigations in progress, the University for Foreigners reaffirms the correctness and transparency of procedures that were followed for the examination taken by Luis Suarez and trusts that this will emerge quickly from the checks that are in progress. Authorities in Perugia are investigating the university's director and general director, but not Suarez, it's important to say. His exam questions and grade were allegedly fixed before he took the test last week. The prosecutor for Perugia says, from the investigation, it's emerged the themes covered by the exam were previously agreed with the candidate and that the relative grade was attributed before he sat the test. Reports in the Italian press claim his tutor told an examiner he could not, quote, utter a word of Italian and so needed help in order to pass, not to blow up this possible transfer to Juventus.
Are you sure it was not an algorithm of some kind which was at
work? It might have been an algorithm, but you do, I mean, without really going lowest common denominator, clearly he didn't have the words in Italian for Giorgio Chiellini at that exact moment years ago, did he? There was no way. He couldn't think of how to express how he felt, so he just bit him.
If you are what you eat, then I guess he is Italian.
Hey!
But this story is quite extraordinary. I was talking to an Italian journalist yesterday about it, and, you know, there's phone tapping and there's, yeah, wiretaps and all this to find out what's gone on. And Juventus are not under investigation. It's the university itself, but I think other, you know, it's whether lots of footballers may have taken this test in this way, and, you know, actually if you sat them down and tried to test them in Italian. Anyway, that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll do any other business, bit of Europa League and other stuff too. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. Now, the Europa League just does not, it doesn't fit with the scheduling of the pod. You know, there's just no way. You know, like, by the time that the pod is published, you've probably got an hour until kickoff. Maybe the game's already kicked off. There's no real point in us previewing it. It means it doesn't really exist in our world. But Tottenham go to Skendija in North Macedonia tonight. Dele Alli's in the squad. He's over there. Rangers play the Dutch team, Willem II. Aberdeen play Sporting Lisbon. Motherwell play Haberwell Beersheva and Celtic up against Riga. And that's our preview, unless anyone really wants to get into it.
I would just like to say that I got an absolute rollicking off a Portuguese person. Right. For calling Sporting Lisbon once.
Oh.
I think it's something you get disabused of once, and then it'll change. They are Sporting Club de Portugal. It's what they are. They're not Sporting Lisbon. It's like calling Nottingham Forest Notts Forest.
Oh, right.
It's just not done.
Connor says, have Sheffield United been found out this season? Thoughts on their relegation prospects? Worst team in the league on paper. They lost 1-0 to Villa on Monday night in a very weird anticlimactic game. Like, John Egan was sent off and it was a red card that no one seemed to be that bothered about. Villa didn't seem to care. Sheffield United didn't seem to care. The referee didn't seem to... No one seemed to care. It was weird. They're home to Leeds at midday on Sunday. Philippe, you're itching to get in.
No, and it's because before the season started, I actually put Sheffield United as being one of my three clubs to go down, which seems really quite harsh. I think there are two things at play here. One of them, what happened to Burnley when they were promoted with Sean Dyche? Do you remember that they actually went down and then back again? Because they didn't quite invest as much as they should have in the team to allow it to have a little bit of breathing space in its second season. To be honest, I think this is what has happened to Sheffield United. I can't see that there's been a huge amount of investment there. The second thing is that a lot of what Sheffield United achieved last season, and which was utterly admirable, had to do with the novelty of their approach to the game. And you can be sure that every single opponent of Sheffield United this season will have gone through their system and will have found ways of countering it, which they didn't necessarily do last year when the surprise lasted for a long time. It took a few months for people to realize, wait a minute, they're playing a kind of system which is new in the Premier League. We have never seen that. They're very efficient. They're very well drilled at it. And people hadn't quite figured out how to counter it. They will have done so. So this season. So it's with greater familiarity with an unusual system or game plan, a lack of reinforcement, the loss of Dean Henderson, big loss. You put all that together and you think, actually, it's going to be a bit difficult for them.
Villa go to Fulham. With all these games moved around for TV, the 6 p.m. Monday night game is, let's face it, it's the shit game. And that's Villa going to Fulham Monday night at 6. City kicked off their season with a 3-1 win at Wolves. They were unbelievable for 45 minutes. I mean, I really thought City would win, would never lose again. And then, Simon, they were sort of pegged back by Wolves in the second half.
Well, they were defending very high. Wolves started, I mean, firstly, Traore came into the game more and was taking on his man down the right flank. So, and finding success there. There was some, Mendy isn't the best defender, the best left back around. So he was getting some success. And they were finding that simple balls over the top of City's defence were playing them into trouble again and again. And there was a period of about a quarter of an hour in the second half when Wolves had 4 or 5 really great chances. Having, like, in the first half, like you say, City were unbelievable. Unbelievable. They won the ball back so quickly and hungrily and then used it so cleverly. They looked phenomenal. But then they actually had a very obvious kind of gaping wound, and Wolves only had to poke their finger in this open wound and they got, they disabled their opponents. So future City opponents watching that game would have been terrified and encouraged.
Yeah, City go to Leicester on Sunday. Wolves go to West Ham on Sunday as well. Elsewhere, Brighton United Saturday 12:30, Palace Everton at 3 o'clock. West Brom Chelsea, the 5:30 game. Slaven Bilic has been fined £8,000 after admitting to a charge of improper conduct during his side's defeat to Everton. He was sent off at half time for not really being particularly rude to Mike Dean. I got told off for the rude words I used about Mike Dean on Monday's pod. It's not befitting a journalist of this established news outlet. Not told off by the bosses, by the way, they didn't care, but some listeners. My apologies to Mr. Dean. Just be slightly less annoying, I would say. Burnley, Southampton, 8 o'clock Saturday night. Tom says, after Sean Dyche compared football clubs to hedge funds, which hedge fund do you support and why? It's a great question. If I open the file of hedge funds in my mind, I have none. Spurs, Newcastle, 2 o'clock Monday night, 8 p.m, Liverpool, Arsenal. The kickoff was going to be 8:15 until people pointed out that full time would come after the pubs close. And I am slightly disappointed that they've moved the kickoff. I love the idea of it being about 85 minutes and the landlord just turning the TV off and going, see you later, everybody. everybody out, Simon.
In further kickoff time changing news, Watford are playing Luton in the Heartbeds Derby, if you will.
Oh, yeah, that is a fiery one.
And the kickoff's been brought forward to 12:30 to prevent crowd disturbance.
Are you serious?
It genuinely has, yeah.
Oh, that's tremendous. That is good, isn't it? In the FA Cup, hashtag United beat Soham on penalties. Interesting story. I mean, like, I suspect everyone sort of my age and up would just be predisposed to hating a team that is called hashtag United. You know, just there's something in it that makes me feel sort of physically ill. But at the same time, actually, their journey is quite interesting. And they are not a joke football team if they're getting to the second qualifying round of the FA Cup. You know, they used to play lots of charity games. They've sort of changed their structure a bit. They've had to let go of some people with lots of followers who can't necessarily kick the ball. And they've become a proper football team. And I suppose, in a time when, if you think about the top of the pod, we're talking about lots of clubs struggling financially. If you can find a way to harness social media, actually that's a really sensible thing to do. And so,
so how do they do that? Do they have a hashtag followed by the by a hashtag when you want to hashtag them on Twitter? So hashtag.
It is hashtag. Yeah, absolutely.
My goodness.
Right. But yeah, they got through on penalties. They got an emergency keeper in on the day of the game. So well done to them. I sent you all the penalty missed by Aylesbury, didn't I? Ollie Bailey is tweeting, four penalties in the 90 minutes, one scored by each side, a further two missed by Aylesbury United. Moneyfields won the shootout 4-3 after seven penalties each. But Anne-Marie, that shot of that penalty going over the stand and just disappearing into the night sky is a thing of absolute poetry, isn't it?
It is. You're absolutely right, Max. It's like it floats. And it's still going and it's still going. I'd love to know where that ball has ended up. I'm surprised that there hasn't been some sort of follow-up on social media about it, because I'd love to know where that ball has gone. And also the reaction of the penalty kicker as well. I'd love to have seen his face properly close up. He kicks the ball and you're just watching the ball go and you don't see his reaction. And I do wonder if he had his head in his hands feeling utterly embarrassed how sky high that ball went. But it's a great clip on social media.
Yeah, I mean, it could be the start of an advert, you know, the ball just disappears and then it just flies away and just goes around the world. Philippe, you had an Estonian bit of news that obviously we all need to hear.
Yes, it was a world record was beaten this week by a club called Nome Kalju, who play in the Estonian championship on the occasion of the 21st round of this competition. It was the quickest substitution in the history of the game, which occurred after 13 seconds, 13-1-3. And the reason why it occurred is that the Estonian League insists that you must have two club-trained players in the starting lineup at kickoff. But it doesn't state how long they've got to be. So at the first throw-in, the manager said, hey, you guy is 16 years old. He's just there to make up the numbers. And he was replaced by a much older player who hadn't been club-trained. So 13 seconds and we've got a new world record thanks to the Estonian championship.
Do you know what? I'm in one of my amateur football games before a really big game, and our left winger Ash was really up for it. And the ball from the kickoff, they take the kickoff and he sprints towards this midfielder, slips, 2 foot their player by mistake, hits his head on the floor, loses a contact lens, gets a migraine and is off the pitch after, I think, 7 seconds earlier substitution. And we've got rolling substitutions now, and I'm quite good at heading it, but I'm not very good at anything else. And we were wondering if I could just sit behind their goal on a chair, and we have a long throw specialist. And when we get a throw-in, just come on for the throw-in and then just take myself off again and sit on the chair. But I'll let you know if I do. Nathan says, is the revelation that Deadpool and Mac from Always Sunny in Philadelphia buying Wrexham the maddest thing to happen in 2020? Yeah, from Wrexham's website. As it says, talks with proposed bidders will now continue. We're in a position to confirm the two people interested in investing in Wrexham AFC. Rob McElhenney is an American actor, director and producer and screenwriter, best known as creator of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, which my wife says is brilliant. I'm about 5 years behind on all these things. Ryan Reynolds is one of my celebrity lookalikes, I like to think. Also Gordon Britas, so, you know, take which one you want. Ryan Reynolds is Ryan Reynolds. On the website it says he's an award-winning Canadian actor, writer, producer, business entrepreneur whose credits include Marvel's Deadpool. In due course, they'll put forward their vision for Wrexham and proposal for members to vote on at a second special general meeting. I mean, that is, I mean, why not, of course, you know, but it certainly made everyone's eyes go, hang on a sec. When you first read it, you're like, is this a real thing? What date is this? But apparently, you know, they've got a lot of money, and if they want to invest it in Wrexham, why not, eh?
I'm hoping that they're both going to come into Wrexham, obviously under social distancing guidelines, and do a PowerPoint presentation to the board.
Oh, yes.
About what, can you imagine them doing that, or doing it over Zoom maybe because it's safer that way. But I just love the idea of these two actor directors and producers coming in to invest in the club, and the excitement that was generated by the announcement yesterday for Wrexham fans, I think is absolutely brilliant. I just love to know, what is it about Wrexham that they saw about the club and why they want to invest in it? But it's giving it, I think it's a little bit of light relief after a particularly heavy year. I think this is something we can finally smile about.
Who are the most famous ex-Wrexham players? And you know, maybe they have a love for them.
Mickey Thomas.
Is Mickey Thomas? Yeah, Mickey Thomas.
It's
the
Mickey
two
Thomas.
One against Arsenal? Okay. there was an alpaca on the pitch at Carlton Athletic. It was called Oscar. I interviewed a photographer. I just had to put that in because I'd put it in the intro. And an apology to Sam Fuller, who messaged to say that Kingsley Black owned a charcuterie in Mallorca. He says, I think the real take home from Tuesday's pod is the absence of source credit for the Kingsley Black charcuterie news, about which I am furious. I suggested maybe it was cut from Monday's episode. He said, I suspected as much. It obviously got cut from Monday. It's fine. It's not like it ruined my week or anything. It ruined my year, brackets, which is a big shout for this year, but I stand by it. The question now, says Sam, is one of reparations. I will accept any of the following: a handwritten apology, a full retrospective credit on the pod, name and home address of the producer, full disclosure, this, if given, will be offer for vengeance. So the producer... Anyway, that's pretty much all we have time for. Philippe, always lovely to talk to you. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you.
Anne-Marie, thank you.
Thank you.
Simon, cheers, mate.
Pleasure.
We will be back on Monday.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.